Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of Tall But True. Another fantastic episode of Tall But True. I am Ben Bailey. I'm here with DC Benny.
Yeah, good to be here. We got a good guest, man. We got a good guest today.
We got a great guest on the line. One of our favorites, a master storyteller and fellow comedian.
Oh, shit.
You are, dude. Come on. You know it.
You know, back in the day when the three of us used to booze like Vikings.
We definitely set some records.
Yeah.
I was doing them. It's funny, you know, because we all go back so far, man.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Right before you guys called, and I was thought, you know, I literally, like, I'm out on Long Island, and I got a six-pack to do this.
Oh, excellent.
Because, you know, because I'm in my shit days in room, and I'm thinking back about, you know, starting out with you guys and stuff. And Bailey, I definitely had to mathematically have drank the most booze with you than any other comedian in my life.
Yeah.
DC's got to be second, if not third. I mean, DC had to talk me onto getting back on a plane in Chicago. We had a layover from Wisconsin. I was so fucking hungover, puking blood.
Because Oh, I remember.
And then I go to D.C., I'll just get a hotel in Chicago. And he's going, bro, just get on the plane. You'll be home in an hour. And then you know, you start thinking about the things that we all remember about each other from back in the day. Like, and D.C., like with you, you are, at least in my world, famous for, because we used to do these crazy travel gigs. No matter how far away you were from home, DC always wanted to fucking drive home that night. You could be in Alaska, and he's like, I'll take it down to Seattle, and you pick it up when we hit Oregon.
Yeah, we did a gig with, and we brought my brothers, at least one of them, and then we got lost on the way back, and it was like 7 hours on the way back or some shit. The transmission was failing.
The thing about that too, I remember, is Christina had, you had something with your wife going that was like if you were a writer, well, like, we needed motivation to get home, and like, I had none, your brothers had none, but you had some shit going on. So you were driving, it was fucking a sheet of ice, and troopers, they couldn't even, they had to hold on to the car door from slipping to tell you not to go.
Yeah. We were passing all these cars like, that were pulled over.
It's only 14 hours. I gotta get home.
Oh,
and then we got back, and we got lost in fucking Queens for an hour, for an extra hour after all that.
You know, I remember that, man. And we would look at the silhouette of Manhattan, and we're like, it's fucking right there. It's right there.
Oh, wow. That's crazy, man. Corey Elliott.
So, yeah, thanks for having me on, guys.
You bet. I don't even know if we introduced you properly. It's Pete Corielli.
The comedian, one and only.
The one and only. And you're working on Kevin Can Wait, right?
Yes, we're out here now. It's funny because, you know, we do it out on Long Island. And last year, you know, and I live upstate out in the small town, as you guys know, outside of Buffalo. So outside, like an hour away from Buffalo, folks. So anyway,
that's nowhere. That's officially right in the middle of Nowheresville.
It really is. I love it, man. It's really cool. Great little town. But
nice.
So last year I got a nicer apartment. It was a nice apartment with the whole tennis court and the pool, because my wife Jackie and my daughter Sadie, they were gonna, like, all right, we'll stay there all summer. But as soon as they came out here and they realized, you know, when you're writing, even if you get out at 6 o'clock, it's like all day. My wife's like, none of her friends are here. There's none of her shit here. We're sitting at a pool with old people. Like, you know, so they didn't want to stay. I'm like, all right. So they split. So now I'm like, I don't need something that nice. So I was telling Kevin James at the end of last year, because I bailed on my lease and I was afraid they were going to come after me for it, you know, but they didn't. So this year, right at the end of last year, it was funny. Kevin goes, Petey, where are you staying this year, next year? And I go, I'm thinking about the Days Inn across the street, because there's a Days Inn basically across the street from our studio. Fucking total dive. and he goes, ouch, that's rough. I go, bro, I got a master plan. I'm going to be there Monday through Thursday, check out Friday morning, fly home every weekend. And he goes, one thing leads to another. And he goes, You know, I think I got to do a shutdown on that because that's a reflection of me. They're going to think I'm not paying you properly. So we all So then this year I do have an apartment. It starts July 1st. It's a grand a month in some old lady and some old man. It's in their basement. Beautiful. And it's month to month. I just want a place to crash because I'm going home every weekend. And they're such weird people, bro. When I gave them the $1,000 deposit, the old lady, she's got a patch on her forehead. She had some surgery. I'm like, I know I have my own entrance in and out of their place. And I know I have my own kitchen, even though I'm not going to use any of that shit. It's totally private. And it's off to the left. I'm like, but it is a little weird living in someone's house. Yeah. And I guess I can do this. And I hand her the money. This is all in my head. And I hand her the money. And she takes the envelope and she goes, "Welcome to the family." and she fucking hugged me. I so bad wanted to be like, "Give me the money back. Give me the money back."
I can't do this. Part of your family. That's not what I'm looking for.
That's not the Hollywood writing life.
Dude, I can't believe Kevin James is making you live in some people's basement.
No. But that don't start till July 1st. So, for the next 2 weeks, I just checked in on Monday to the Days Inn. And we're in the writer's room. And Kevin's like, you're not at the Days Inn, right, Petey? I go, yeah, I did a hard check-in today. Got a place lined up. Because this is not going to work long-term. When I pulled in, it was a rainstorm. And the next morning, three people staying in this shit box. they couldn't get to their cars because the sewers clogged and their cars were flooded up to the fucking wheel well. So the guy, the Mexican guy who runs the joint, has a pump in the puddle and he's shooting it onto the grass. And these people are sipping coffee, waiting for the water to go down so they can get to their car.
You're going to have to integrate some of that into the show, man.
Oh, yeah, shit. But it's good to be hanging with you guys in my Days Inn room in the meantime with my beers.
Yeah, it's great, dude. It's awesome. Yeah, I love that you got a six-pack to hang.
Yeah.
Seriously, old friend. And
we're drinking beers, too.
I'm toasting you, Bailey, right now to a resurrection of Cash Cab.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, pal.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Cheers
absolutely.
To that.
Thank Cheers to us. That, man. Yeah.
I was almost accidentally in the back of that fucking cab one time.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, because Jimmy, you know Jimmy Cano, the big Italian guy who
he got in the cab. Jimmy. He broke the seats.
Did he?
I swear to God, he broke the seats.
Well,
were you guys, with him?
Well, no, but you guys disguise those shows sometimes as like he thought he was going on an audition for some Italian Guido shit.
I don't know anything about that.
Yes. So, sorry.
I'm just fucking around.
He's like, listen, man, you might want to meet this casting director. He's like, whatever hoax you guys use to get him on the fucking street corner also worked. He's like, you might want to come along too. And I'm like, I don't know. He's like, well, it'll be fun. Keep me company. And then he calls me the next day. He's like, bro, remember that thing? So I'm waiting there, and then a cab pulls up, and it's Bailey, and it's Cash Cab.
He got in the cab, and he sat. He couldn't sit in one of the seats, basically. If he sat on one, he was like kind of on both. And he sat right down, and I don't know how he did it, but there's like the front of the seats are like this sort of pleather material. And then the back is hard plastic, and that hard plastic part sort of comes around down on the side of the seats. Somehow he sat on the both of the seats in the middle row of the cash cab and broke these big plastic pieces off of both of them in one fucking shot. And he goes, I think I just broke the fucking cab. it was this whole big thing. We had to stop down and like try to get the back fixed. I don't remember how he did, if he even played. I don't even know if he played or if he lost or what.
DC, do you know who Cano is, Jimmy?
Yeah,
Cano?
I know Cano. I know him well. And he started working at Gotham for a while, right? Wearing suits and getting all decked out and stuff.
You got to wear a suit. You want to work for Chris Mazzilli? You got to wear a suit.
Jimmy Cano, he's a big guy, great guy, as you guys
Love
know.
Love that guy.
And works at Gotham, but, you know, he used to be married to Lisa Lampanelli.
Right.
The comedian.
Yes.
And the way Cano got kind of involved in this whole comedy scene in any capacity was He knows Brewer, and some of the guys Brewer went to high school with, Jim Brewer. So
okay.
So when we had a radio show at Sirius, me and Jim and his high school buddies were there. Cannell would come sometimes. And then I pretty quickly became friendly with him. And he had a buddy who owned the steakhouse. So he would come on the radio show, you know, once a month. He'd bop in. Hey, we'll go to the steakhouse. And he became friends of ours in the show. It wasn't on much, but once in a blue moon, he'd come on. So one time, we're bringing him on for something. And Lisa Lampanelli was on that show. So he was waiting until she was done, and then he came on. Now, I'm not kidding. You cut to about 8 months later, I get a phone call from Cano. And, you know, it's not like I haven't talked to him in 8 months, but he calls me out of nowhere, and he's like, hey, what are you doing? I'm like, whatever, what? I just called to tell you I got a new girlfriend, you know, which is a little fucking weird that he would do that. And I'm like, yeah, all right. And he goes, well, you know her. And I'm like, yeah, all right. And he goes, she's right here. She wants to say hi. Before he finishes, Lampanelli grabs the phone. She goes, what's up, motherfucker? That's right. I'm off black guys. I'm dating your friend. You know? And I go, what the fuck? So then next time I see Cano, he's telling me the story. And this is a little tale for anyone out there who's afraid to find love. Jimmy Cano, this is how crazy, this is a story Cano tells me, right? And, you know, we all know Lisa Lampanelli is one of the most famous comedians in America, man. So, and she clearly was at that point already. So she's on a show, and after the show, she comes out, and this is Cano telling me the story, and he goes, you know, and I chatted with her for a few minutes while she was waiting for her assistant to get off the phone, and it ended up being a 15-minute conversation. She seemed very nice, and just, I don't know, just seemed like we were kind of clicking. So Cano had a girlfriend at the time. I think she even had a boyfriend. Cut to literally 7 months later, he's like, you know, I'm single. I'm sitting home in my apartment. And I just kind of thought about, man, I really thought there was maybe a spark there, you know? He calls up Lampanelli's publicist and says, hi, my name is Jimmy Cano. And she's like, yeah, listen, I met Lisa once on Brewer and Corielli's show. And, you know, I'm a friend of theirs. And we chatted. I know there's a long shot, but we had a nice conversation. And, you know, I just let her know, here's my number. If she ever wanted to go out and get some dinner, I'd love to take her out. Just on a whim, the publicist tells Lisa, because she's like, seemed like a nice guy, said this. And then on a whim, Lisa goes, we did. He was nice. You know, I'll go. And all these little things clicked. And then, I mean, you know, they're divorced now, but they had a good 3-year run. You know? Yeah.
Back to the black guys is the moral of that story.
That's hilarious. This is for anyone who's out there thinking they won't find love.
Yeah, right.
You'll find it, and then you'll fucking lose it again.
Yeah. Well, temporary love.
Temporary love. It's fleeting, isn't it?
Yes. Especially with a comedian, yeah.
That was happening right around that time. I think he told me that. Yeah. That he... That he was married to her. That when you know, they were already married by the time he broke the cab, right?
Mm-hmm. If not, they were already dating, you know, and then that led him being into the comedy world. But I love it too, though, when he's finally married to Lisa. I mean, he calls me one particular time. I gotta tell you, guy. I mean, sometimes, you know, I hear you complain about the road, but I've been on now with a month and a half with Lisa. We're having a really good time. I go, where are you right now? Where are you right now? He's like, Chicago. No, I go, where in Chicago? At a steakhouse. I go, yeah, at a steakhouse. Why don't you Google the closest fucking Subway sub shop, go there, get a sub, and then walk to the closest Residence Inn or Holiday Inn Express. Eat that shit, and then wait for some dude you don't even know in a fucking 1975 Mustang to pick you up and tell you he's the opener. And then go.
And then have your check bounce.
Yeah,
then have your check bounce, yeah.
Yeah.
And he's... So. And then the middle guy is trying to show you up, right? He thinks he's as good a comedian as you are. He's trying to. He's got a 20-minute spot with no checks.
Did you guys ever?
He wants
have
to make
that,
a go like, of it.
Like DC, did you ever have either one of you guys? Like, were you ever on the road where you're headlining and literally? You were having trouble following the feature act for whatever reason.
I knew where you were going with that. There was a club in Tennessee that I did, and they booked this local middle that was a headliner, you know, and he knew all the references. Oh, what the fuck was this? It was Big Somebody, like Big, I don't know, Big John or Big Al or somebody like that.
Was it this, big Jim Cano?
No. But this dude would go on and annihilate. And I had just kind of started working the road and was, you know, you got that New York material. You're trying to make it work a little bit. And,
yeah, it's a different, yeah. It's a different game, yeah.
So I hadn't really developed my sort of global U.S. material yet that I've, you know.
Whatever.
I'm doing shit about Puerto Ricans and cabs and, you know, whatever the fuck it is.
And they're like, what's a Puerto Rican?
Yeah.
We don't have those out here.
But I swear to God, it was at night after. I would go in the bathroom and I would hear people come in the bathroom. I'd be in the stall and they're like, that first guy was. And the guy would do like 40 too. They would let him go long.
Oh, that's good.
Oh, God, he'd annihilate. And then I'd try and sell CDs afterwards. They buy all his fucking T-shirts, ignore me. You know, you hear him in the bathroom like, that other guy should be the one that closes. I don't know that New York City fella ain't that goddamn funny, you know.
Oh,
that's
man.
The worst, dude. That's the worst.
That is brutal.
It's funny, DC, because when we were young and we were first starting out, I distinctly remember, like, first time seeing you at New York Comedy Club. I think you were the first comic that ever had any kind of a nickname that I knew of either, you know? But you crushed, but you were very urban. Like, I mean, you had a lot of New York City references and characters and stuff. So if you lived in the city, you crushed. And it's funny because as you got older, it's almost like what's the word I want to use? Intentionally kind of got away from that and wanted to become this more longer storyteller, you know, like because I mean, sometimes when you tell these long stories and they're with you and you know there's going to be parts where they're with you, but they're not laughing, it's so funny. Like, if someone for half a second goes, you're not really laughing, you want to be like, guy, I can turn around and do a fucking Chinese fucking book at Dega shop owner. I mean, you used to do all those things and crush, bro. Remember that?
I remember those days.
Of course you remember
buddy.
That, man.
Yeah, I remember those days.
I mean, you're crushing now, but it's just a different kind of crushing. Isn't it funny how we evolved? Damn.
Well, you know how you change, man. You know how you change. It's I was coming from a circuit. I was coming from the black circuit, so I had to, there wasn't room to have artistic pause. I had to go in there and fucking, there was just bring the concentrate. And
then the pause was seen as an opportunity.
Yeah, to be heckled or whatever. So, but now like, you know, you get older, you get more autobiographical. You get sick. You know, it's like, this is what the fuck I'm going to do. You get weirder?
I get weirder. I just write about more obscure and weird stuff.
But you always
on it even more, you know, like stay on the same topic forever.
Yeah.
But even then, you're almost speaking to what DC's saying, because you're basically doing more of what you want to do is what you're doing. And and Bailey, I remember you used to go for a good run. First of all, I remember like your first big joke at the Cellar. We started out so long ago. I remember at least it was one of the first ones. I remember you got a big laugh. You would say, I remember the night you first said it too. You're like, I went to take a shit today or a dump and I had no toilet paper. So I'm like, now I had to take a shower. And then you remember you had that shit joke. You'd have that run for a while where no matter what the crowd was like, you could always go up and start out with, when I go home after this show,
my girlfriend's underwear.
Yeah.
I used to say, wife, I'm going to tear my wife's underwear as soon as I get up home. And there'd be a pause, and you go, because my balls are killing me.
That was the best, dude. That fucking joke.
Oh, I flattered you guys. I think I opened with that 100,000 times.
Oh, yeah, dude. But it was that's the barometer, though. You know, when you have that killer opener, and then you put it out there, and if they don't bite, you're like, holy fuck, this is going to be a long set.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. I mean, Lenny Marcus, a comedian we all know well out of New York City.
Leonard was on the show. He told some stories.
You know how Lenny always starts with his glasses on, and he looks out at the crowd and goes, I know what you're thinking, computer programmer.
Yeah.
Right?
Can this guy fix my printer?
can this guy fix my printer? So one random night, we're in the Cellar, and it's packed, and of course, I got my beer, and I'm down there, and Lenny's on right before me. I go down to watch him, and Keith Robinson is someone's introducing Lenny, and as he introduced him, I'm leaning over to Lenny with my beer. You know, Lenny don't drink at all, right? And I'm going, don't open with the printer thing. I dare you. Just fucking don't open it. Don't open it. And he goes,
anything else.
What are you, crazy? And it's literally, it's his way of every night, like, dipping your toe into a pool before you jump in. Depending on how they respond to that joke is depending on how he's going to feel about the whole night.
Yeah.
Miserable. Sure. It's Lenny. He'll be unhappy in the end. He'll be happy but complaining in the end, regardless.
Yeah, no. Lenny's there's nothing like those nights. Like, I've been opening for Regan over the past year and a half here and there when I can and when he asks. And, you know, like, having become more and more friendly with him, he's such a fucking awesome guy. You know, there's a little more leg room opening for him to do new stuff. You know, I almost think he wants.
I bet his crowds are awesome.
Yeah.
They are very awesome. But, you know, they're also very, you know, he's for everybody from 5 to 500. So, man, you know, sometimes you think you edited your shit down, but then you go into a bit and you're like, oh, wait a second. I don't think I can do this punchline. You know?
Right. You it's too, they want it really clean, huh?
And then you just fade out of a bit. You know, half the crowd's like, he needs to think his thoughts through. And you're like, oh, no.
You need an ending for that one.
You don't want to hear about the sodomy.
You're cutting an ass-fucking joke before the ass-fucking. I don't know how well that's going to go over.
But I, the reason I bring it up is because I got a little too loose recently, and I opened up, you know, like with a show. We were in Topeka or something, and I do some jokes about the town, and like nobody's with me, nobody. Huh. And you're just like, every time you do that, you're like, especially because nobody knows me, you know what I mean? So it's not like they're going to go, oh, Petey will turn it around. He always does.
Yeah.
All like
right. Yeah, they doubt you.
Yeah. So you just, and when you do that, you're just sitting there going, why the fuck do I do this? Why don't I just do a regular joke? I mean, even Seinfeld says, it's comedy suicide to open with a new joke.
Yeah.
But we all do it once in a while. We all do it.
I'll tell someone not to do it, some young dude, and then I'll go fucking do it. And I'm like, what am I doing? I just told that kid, don't do that.
Let me show you. I told you. Now I'm going to show you. Here's why you don't do it. So wait, what do you say? Opening with a new bit.
Especially, you know, if it's like, you know, if you're super famous, do what you want. But I'm just saying, if I'm playing with, oh, DC, that made me laugh so hard because I've actually pontificated with the feature and the MC so much in a green room that I'm on stage and I'm literally like, holy shit. Don't talk to the crowd. You told them not, like I'm thinking of all the lessons I just taught them.
Wisdom you just shared.
Do what I say, not what I do.
I can't stand when I go someplace and I feel like the MC and feature don't like. You know, I'll be honest. I like when they have me on a little bit of a pedestal. Like, you know, they quote a couple of.
They should.
The other ones that are like, they just hang out. Like, oh, man, it's such a long week when I don't like the feature in the MC. It's such a long week.
Sometimes you get a guy who's like a good comedian, and he's got his shirts, and he's got his local references and stuff, and he still is respectful and nice. But he's a good comedian.
Yeah.
Yes.
And then sometimes you get someone who doesn't have any of that, but it's like a young guy who just thinks he's like smarter.
Well, they can't speak in the green room. They can't talk to you in the green room or whatever.
He's just going to sit in my fucking green room and work on his laptop and not say anything. And they don't say anything about your set. But you know they come and watch. And then they don't say anything. It's like, all right.
You see, to me, I don't
care. Know what game you're playing, but.
They don't, you know, look, you don't have to fucking praise me or whatever, but don't be a douche in the green room. Be cool in there. Let's talk, you know, have a beer or a fucking seltzer water, whatever, you know.
Relax.
But let's
have a cream soda.
Let's do some talk or whatever. Don't, you know, you know, let's not be aloof and, you know, withholding of the craft.
Aloof
and,
is perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't like that shit.
Yeah. I don't need someone to kiss my ass. I don't even like that. But don't sit in here and like brood as though you're the genius, when you know. Come on, let's have a little bit of realism.
You're both not being completely honest though, in the sense that maybe you're saying you don't want the guy to kiss your ass, and I don't either. But
I'll take it.
no, but you got to admit this. You have a, like, you know, you're pontificating, telling a story, and then the feature goes into a story, and you're like, "Guy, you just interject on my stories. You don't. What the fuck? What the? This is my platform. You know, you don't take 5 minutes chunks. You take a minute here.
Throw a tag. That's it.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
This reminded me of hilarious. So funny. Story. I'm standing in the stairway of the old Boston in the front there with Godfrey. And this is when Godfrey first arrived in New York, and he had kind of like a bigger hairdo, and he had glasses.
Oh, yeah.
Remember Godfrey with his glasses?
Yeah, I knew him then.
Yeah.
And he was embarrassed about his car, so he would park it like 40 blocks away and walk to the clubs.
Or he'd have his girlfriend park and drive him to spots.
And drive around, Fucking Godfrey. Hilarious.
Hilarious.
Godfrey and I are standing in the stairway talking about our set or something. And at the time, Pete, are you taking a piss right now?
Yes, I am.
We can hear everything, dude.
I'm sorry.
That's so Corielli, man. Oh, my God.
That is so Days In.
You gotta remind me to tell you the time I took a piss on DePaulo's property and he got all fucking bent out of shape.
Did he really?
Oh, it's a whole story. It's a whole story.
But so I want to hear that for sure. But so Godfrey and I are, and like we're both doing like a half an hour at the end of the shows every night there.
Yeah.
And it's great.
Where?
At the old Boston.
Oh, okay, yeah.
Like whatever night, I would just go in and close the show with like 30, and it was a great time of growth as a comedian, and it was really fun. You know?
Great club.
So but it could be brutal, as we've talked about on previous episodes.
Part of the greatness of it, I'm saying though.
Absolutely, you know,
absolutely. For growth. Like
oh
you
my
said.
God,
a wake up call,
going heavy.
Yeah.
So we're talking about our sets, and there's some young girl standing there talking who. Stand there next to us while we're talking, and I guess she's like she wants to be a comic or whatever, and Godfrey says something, I say something, Godfrey says something, she starts to say something, and Godfrey goes, "Shut up!" He goes, "You're just an extra in this scene. You don't have any lines."
Oh shit. Oh, I love it.
And she just had to take it. Like, she was like, "I want to be a comedian. I don't know what to do. I just have to stay."
Godfrey brought that Chicago ruthlessness.
Yeah.
Oh, that's funny.
But it's funny because of that, you know. And I honestly don't want the openers or features on the road to kiss my ass.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But you're right, Pete. That doesn't mean I want to sit there and listen to them tell fucking stories all day. And.
Just
and the last thing
respect.
You want to do is like get into one of these like who's the funnier conversation like
yeah
but you should defer honestly if you're you know
of course man it's of like, course you'd...
out of respect
yeah just look there's a line chef in the kitchen and then there's the main fucking cook that's you know whipping everything up there so,
yeah there's
know,
the chef
chop
and the
up the celery
chef.
And.
And then there's some people that never should have tried to be chefs.
Right, exactly.
Once in a while, you get one of those guys. You know what else you get sometimes on the road? You get a guy who's middling for you, who's around our age and has been doing stand-up for fucking 20 years in whatever area that he's in. And those are usually awesome because those guys will be like, "Oh, I know your stuff. It's, you know, I love this bit. I love that bit." And you can hang with those guys and like... But I love it when that happens.
I hung out with this guy, Bill Blank. You know this guy?
Billy Blanks? The Tybo guy?
No, his name's Bill Billy Blanks. His real name's Bill Burr. But because...
What?
Yeah.
Oh, but, yeah. Isn't he from the same area, too? Where's he
I
from?
Think he's from the Midwest. We were working somewhere in the Midwest. This guy was funny as fuck. And we were hanging. He'd been doing comedy a long time. He was like always middling. You still there, Corielli?
Mm. I think Pete just was putting his dick away, and
he's putting
hung
his
up
dick
on
away,
us.
Hitting a one hitter, and then.
I love how guys come out and they just chat. We're getting a call, everybody. I wonder who it is.
Hello.
Did you have to zip up?
No, sorry, Lush. We left off right when DC said funny as fuck, and he had been doing comedy.
All right, so dude's been doing comedy a long time. Funny as fuck.
We're still recording?
We're still recording.
We're good.
Still recording. Boom. We're hanging out, and we're having normal conversation.
Yeah.
And I told him some story about being on a soap opera or whatever, and he was like, dude, you got to tell that fucking story on stage. You got to tell that story on stage.
Right.
And I was like, I don't know, man. There's a lot of fat in that. He's like, dude, tell that story on stage. I'm telling you. It was a funny bone, one of the funny bones. And I told it that night, and it worked. And it was really because this guy was like, it never occurred to me, you know? Wow. But that's an ideal scenario.
What soap opera were you on?
As the World Turns. It was a...
I said that like it makes any difference to me at all. Like I watched one of them. Exactly. But what happened? Like, who were the big...
I remember that!
Dude, what did you play? Were you like a killer or something fun?
I was the bodyguard of one of the main dudes. I had a nice run on it for...
Nice, dude.
And the story was about, you know, I don't have kids, and I never really wanted kids, but they were like, in order to be on this, you got to take care of this baby. On the show, part of the role was that you had to take care of this baby, this like newborn.
Wow.
And he wasn't newborn, he's about a year. And then the thing was, I got there. I'm not gonna tell the whole story, but I got there.
Tell it. It's a storytelling show.
Well,
you know, I mean, you don't have to, but
here's the thing.
It's pretty fucking interesting so far. I never got an acting role that came with a baby.
Yeah. So I get a call to be on the soap opera.
I never got an acting role.
With or without a baby. I remember you, Pete, saying, if I was auditioning to play myself, I wouldn't get it. All right, go ahead. So the world is turning, and
basically,
as it does.
I grew up taking care of my little brother. And when he would cry, I would make this sound. I go bow 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 bow, and that it would make him laugh, right? And that was my job in the house. My parents always like, make this sound, bow 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 bow, and he start laughing. So I go, I never wanted kids, right? I like being an uncle. That's enough, you know, whatever. So like, to soap opera, get this audition. It's gonna be like 4 or 5 episodes to be this bodyguard, and for the main character. So I go in. And the lady's like, I get there, and one of the security guys, a bouncer for, I think he was a bouncer at the Cellar.
The guy who's playing the role? No, the guy at
the studio.
Okay.
And so he's when like, you get there for the audition, you're saying?
Yeah, when I get there for the audition, outside the studio, the security guy is like, hey, man, what are you doing here? I'm like, hey, what are you doing here? And I said, I'm here, you know, to do this audition for, you know, the body. Chaz is the guy's name. He's like, Chaz? He's like, so he goes, did they tell you about the baby? I'm like, no. And he goes, they didn't tell you about the baby. I'm like, no. And he's like, look, this baby's a big contract player on the show. And basically, if the baby doesn't like you, you get fucking fired. There have been like 11 Chaz's already. So he's like, you're good with kids, right? And I'm like, yeah. You know,
like, I have a cat.
Yeah, I got a cat. So I go in.
It hates me.
Exactly. Pees in my shoes. I go into the room. The dressing director comes in. He's like, we're going to introduce you to the baby. And no direct eye contact, no sudden movements, any of that shit. It's crazy, right? I'm in a little fucking dressing room. Take me to the baby's dressing room. Baby's got a manager, an agent, just like a fruit basket.
How old is the baby about? Like, what are we talking?
I'm thinking, like, I can never tell with babies, like, how old. But
it's hard,
like,
to tell, yeah.
Not even a year?
Nah, I think a little older. Maybe a little bit older.
Like 16?
That's your audition.
I have no fucking idea. Like a yearish. I think a yearish, something like that.
Like a 1-year-old.
DC, your first acting gig that you ever landed, you got from Shaking a Rattle.
That's basically it, dude. So they hand me the baby. There's an Indian nanny there. She's got the baby. Right? They hand me the baby. The baby starts to cry, so I do that noise. I go, bow, 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 bow. And the baby starts laughing. Director's like, that's fucking great. Keep doing that noise. That's great. We just want somebody who can take care of this baby. So we keep doing, we start shooting these episodes, 2, 3, 4 episodes. and the baby really starts liking me. And I find out stuff like the baby doesn't have a dad. It's very sad, like all this shit. And soon Jesus. The baby doesn't want to be held by anybody else. You know, even the Indian nanny, she's trying to do the thing. She's like, and the baby's like, ah! You know? So they add episodes on. I've like 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. I get there and I'm in it a lot. You know, I'm in it a lot. I got the baby. It's great. Get to like the 10th. Go ahead.
Because it's almost as if, listen, we need this baby in a lot of scenes.
That's it.
The only one who can hold it with his fucking thing, don't cry.
That's it. That was it. I was a glorified babysitter.
But that was it. You're an on-camera nanny.
That's exactly what it was. Just fucking taking care of this baby.
How does it end?
So
as the world turns, what happened?
Well, I'm going to cut out a large part of it, but basically the baby got fired and they had another baby come in. The baby's mother was making demands or something like that, wanted like a 35% pay raise.
It grew up.
I don't know. When baby wanted a new Audi. I don't know what the fuck it was. So they get another baby. Everything's good with that baby. We get to the 12th episode. The director comes in. He's like, look, we want to do like a romantic storyline with you and this older lady, right? So he's like, how would you feel about that? You'd be like having to make out on camera and stuff like that.
Whoa.
And I'm like,
do you have a picture of her?
I'm like, all right.
I'm totally riveted by this story.
Well,
and by the way, I mean, The Graduate, one of the greatest movies of all time. I can't believe you were even hesitating. It's like an actor's choice, bro. What's the problem?
I'm in there.
An older lady.
I'm in there. I'm like, all right. So he goes,
would you like me to seduce you?
Mrs. Robinson.
Yeah.
So he's going to, we're going to introduce you, right? So he takes me to meet the lady. And she's not into it at all. Like, she wanted a story, but she's like, this guy's not even an actor. He's a fucking comedian. You know, blah, 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 blah. She's like, and I guess the joke's on me, and walks out of the room, right? So,
what the fuck?
So, boom. The guy's like, don't worry about it. Learn your lines, right? Show up tomorrow. We're going to try it out.
We're going to make it happen.
Show up the next day.
You're going to force yourself on her.
I got the baby, the new baby. I put the baby down. And the thing is, I got to like wrestle with this lady, fucking make out with her. It's like way out of my comfort zone.
Yeah.
Jesus, man.
We're in the makeup room, and I see, like, there's this, she's got, like, this cornflake or something. Like, she's been eating cornflakes just sitting on her lip, right?
Oh.
And
that's attractive.
She goes to the makeup guy, could you do something about this? And the guy's like, I don't know, man. I mean, that's like, time and zinc, you know? I mean, this thing is like a, it's not a cornflake. I don't know what the fuck it is.
It's, like, but stuck. It's part of her lip.
It's... something's going on there that is shouldn't be there.
Jesus.
I'm looking at the thing. Things looking at me, you know, whatever. So we go do the scene and everything. And I'm like, we got to make... So I put, like, Vaseline on my lip, like, as a protective barrier or some shit. Because I don't know what the fuck that thing is. And the director's like, why are your lips all shiny? You look like you've been eating fried chicken. Get that shit off your lips.
You're like, you see this lady? I got to kiss.
I got this shit off the lips, right? So we do the thing. And we're making out, but I'm kissing all around that. I'm not sure.
You're
what the
avoiding
hell it is.
The bump, the flake.
I'm avoiding it. And the director's like, you know, cut. He's like, it doesn't look real. Doesn't look like there's no chemistry. I'm like, chemistry, you better run out to that CVS, get some Abreva. I don't know if you saw that little raisin in the sun in the corner over there. So I get released after that. I don't know what the deal is. I get released. And I guess about 6 months later, I get a call from The Guiding Light. It's another soap opera.
Right.
And they're like, we got a part for you to play like Julio the janitor or some shit like that. And I'm like, I don't have to audition. They're like, no, just show up, right? No, I don't have to audition. I show up. The first person I see on the set is the baby's mother. I'm like, the original baby's mother? I'm like, what are you doing here? She's like, they hired the baby. They needed a dude. We put in a word. You're fucking in here, man. Wow. She's like, wait till he brings the baby out. The baby's gotten bigger, and she looks at me. He's like, bow, 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 bow. So that's a bit of the baby story.
Jesus, man. You got another gig.
You know what's so wild? Like taking it back to the comedian world. DC, you know how I remember all that?
Huh.
Because, wow, I've I almost never forgot this, but obviously I never forgot it because I'm remembering it now. Do you remember the time me, you, and Keith Robinson, this is right around the time you're doing this stuff, we were playing like some college in New York City, and you had just gotten maybe the second role or that role, and we're all sitting in the green room, you know, and you know how we are, especially when we're young, coming out of New York City, we're like, we're comics, man, we're comics, keeping it real, you know, and I just, you know, smoke my
You're
little
hardcore,
weed,
no doubt.
My weed outside, and I come back in, and I'm like, DC, bro, you should totally zone in on this soap opera stuff, man. There's no reason not to. I mean, you're such a good-looking guy. I mean, you're on your second part. I mean, bro, you could make – no, they make a lot of money. And Keith just starts to the tip of Keith. He goes,
oh, yeah.
Listen to you tell DC to be a soap opera. I go, no, Keith, I'm serious. There's no reason not to get there. I go, we go out to Governors and we open up for these soap opera stars just and they get all the money, you know, and I remember you being like, you weren't taking this, you were almost a little offended. And I'm like, shit, man, I didn't mean it that way.
You should be a soap star.
Oh, shit.
You're like,
man.
I'm a comedian.
Well, you, Corielli, I'm trying to remember. I saw, what was that? You were telling that story of that movie you did like way back when we were on Brewer's show.
Yeah, you guys were on Brewer's show together, right? I remember coming into
Corielli
the city,
got me on there.
And you guys were on there.
Corielli got me on
yeah.
there.
Yeah, that was some weird thing.
It was.
I did a run on a soap.
You did?
I did, yeah. I played a prison guard on One Life to Live.
Uh-huh.
And what an interesting world that is.
It is.
The
dude.
Soap opera world, man. It's
well,
crazy.
It's boot camp for acting. That's one thing for dude. Fucking sure. You know, people look at it and they're like, ah, these guys can't. Those guys can fucking act. They got to learn those lines every day.
And make them believable
them quick.
To some degree. Yeah, it's not
they
easy,
They want one
man.
Take. They want one take so they can keep it moving.
This you know? One guy that was the...
Well, then I give him kudos for every day, but part two, Bailey, make him believable. I have yet to see that happen ever.
I love you call that part two.
Yeah.
Yeah, because I mean, it's
I don't mean believable like they're going to win an Oscar, but like to make it even passable. Like often the lines that you have on those shows are like, how the fuck am I going to say this?
Exactly.
And make this even like keep it from ruining the storyline by it being so bad, you know?
Well, like, you hear them refuse out there like when they get to a certain level, I'll be like, they'll refuse to say that shit.
Yeah, I'm not
like,
saying
I'm not
that.
Saying that fucking thing, you know.
There was one guy when I was on One Life to Live, I was a prison guard who was like the top henchman of this criminal overlord who like ran the prison from within, you know. And the guy who played him, I was like, have you done a lot of soaps? He's like, he started laughing. He goes, so many. I think he said I've played 48 different roles just on this one. I was like, what? He started rattling off all the characters he had played on that show. And it was unbelievable.
Like, yeah.
He played two of his own twin brothers. So I'm like, how do you have two twins? Aren't you guys triplets then? He's like, well, no, there was separate storylines. I'm like, okay, but you can't have three twins. Then they're not fucking twins anymore. They're triplets. He played the ghost of himself, you know, like he just played all these different characters on the same show.
That's crazy.
I tell you though, no matter what I thought about acting, you know, and I'm always like, you know, I was always the one, the actors are so great, this one's great. So now for the first time in my life, writing on a sitcom, like last season being, you know, the actors we have on the show are very talented people and they're very funny, but you just have... It's such a different take now when you're writing it because you have it like we'll have these table reads on Monday and we all sit in the room and, you know, they film it for people in L.A. to see live and it's a whole big thing. But all the writers, we're over here in the back and, you know, it's like these jokes and stuff, they're your little babies. So, you know, you hear someone do your joke and I'm whispering to the guy next to me, holy shit, does anybody get fucking sarcasm around here? Because they're delivering the lines like, you know, very like trying to be serious and you're like, that's not what I mean. And you get, and the thing that's so frustrating is that, and you guys doing more of the acting than I have, do you care if someone tells you how to do it? Because it's like this goddamn charade where you when you're talking to the actor and you're like, maybe you should try to do it, you know, think about it this way. And you just want to go, listen, I could curve about 45 minutes right now on everything and just show you how to do it and just imitate what that, you know?
Right, because you know what the goal is. You know how you wrote it.
And that's so
I would love, there's a lot of times when I would love someone to tell me, and this is more in the audition process, but certainly if you book the role, I would love for them to say, this is how we're seeing this guy. Because it's often difficult to see a joke or a meaning in someone else's writing if it's not explicit.
Yeah.
So any subtlety and shit could be misinterpreted. And then you're like, all right. I try to go through, if it's for a sitcom or whatever, I go through and I mark, all right, this is where I think these are meant to be punchlines and why, and then try to figure it out around that. To answer your question, I think I would be happy to have someone say, this is what I was, if you could have the writer, it's like that scene in Annie Hall when, I think it's Annie Hall, when they're waiting in line for the movie.
Oh yeah,
and this
guy's
like talking on, going on about what the director meant, and then the director's behind them.
Yeah.
And he's like, "No, that's not what I meant at all.
You know absolutely nothing of my
work.
You
don't know anything about my work." And then Woody's like, "Wouldn't it be nice if life was really like that? It feels like that. Like I would love to have someone tell me sometimes if I don't know.
Well, I mean, because it's just the way you say it. Like, I mean, I have actually, you know, done a couple things through the years and years and years ago, as you guys know, I was Jim Brewer was coming off of Saturday Night Live. And he had a sitcom pilot where I ended up getting the part as the best friend. But the role, the character's name was Pete. And it was, I helped write that part. And it was so specific to the cadence that I talk. Yeah. And Jim obviously wanted me to have the part. But more importantly than anything, Jim wanted to have a show on TV that was successful.
Of course.
I'm doing well, and looks like I'm getting called into the last three auditions. And like the day before, Brew was like, it's looking good, man. We haven't really seen anyone else who's getting the cadence and stuff. But again, like I said, he wants it to be me, but he wants it to be whoever's best. And then the next day, he calls up and he's like, good news, bad news. Bad news is most people, bad, bad, bad. But Rogel came in and he's kind of doing a version of you and he's crushing it, guy.
Oh, shit.
Like, because you're like, damn. Because Rogel, you know, he's like, he knows. All right. You're obviously doing Pete. I know how Pete is. He's got the inside track, which is what an actor should do. But we don't normally have privy to that, you know?
Yeah.
And the minute you do, you're like, uh-oh, now it's actually skill involved? I'm fucked.
You got outpeated. That's something else. When I've heard that from a few guys, though, that somebody has written a part for them on a show, on a pilot.
And then someone else gets it.
Someone else that they know gets it, you know? Like another comic is playing you.
Yeah.
Oh,
it's the strangest thing, man.
It's fucking brutal.
Like, wow. Yeah. That's crazy, dude. That's crazy. Hey, we were going to talk about Corielli's got that one story, dude. Bailey.
Yeah, we're almost an hour in, though, and we've been talking mostly showbiz stuff. We were going to talk about house guests.
Yeah.
Yeah, you guys.
But we can talk about this more. I mean, Pete, we'd love to have you come on and tell stories again.
Yeah.
I'm not in any rush to leave. I mean, you know, guys,
yeah, we know you're at a Days Inn across the street from the studio all by yourself, drinking and smoking and peeing. I'm fucking with you, bro. But I'm happy to keep talking along these lines. Like, I think it's interesting stuff. I once went to a voiceover audition.
Uh-huh.
And the breakdown said, we're looking for someone with a voice like comedian Ben Bailey.
Really?
And I didn't get it.
Oh,
for real.
Shit.
Like, that actually happened.
Wow. Well, Godfrey got it.
But this is obviously after Cash Cab had already been out. Yeah. Or
no,
out,
no.
Right?
This is before.
Before Cash Cab.
Yeah. That's the strange part.
That
because
is
whoever it was clearly had seen me somewhere, somehow, or knew me from the comedy circuit and wanted a voice like mine. Because nobody fucking knew who I was, but they didn't book me.
Yeah,
that's
just, man, just very confusing.
Those commercials. I mean, I never landed a commercial. DC, you definitely, obviously, not only landed them, but you always had more. You always had more perseverance with the commercial audition, and I just couldn't stomach it sometimes, man.
God,
because
I hear
I mean, and like, I mean, we all have so many stories, but the one that just literally stands out, I doubt it was the one that made me never do another one again or anything, but I just remember it standing out, is we were supposed to be on a treadmill in the audition, as was saying something about, I don't know, a fucking sneakers or a head, I don't know what, something, but we're on a treadmill. And they had no treadmill, so I'm supposed to run
just
in place.
Jogging in place.
Yeah, and it was just like, this is, and it was just some mundane shit you're saying. It had nothing to do with your talent or skill. So
those things
rough.
Are they will break you, the commercial.
Those are so rough.
Oh.
But
you wait around
life,
a lot,
man.
And then they're over so quickly. And
you
it's know? All about how you look. Yeah, they could change your life, no doubt.
And it's lucky. It's lucky. Like, I mean, it really is. I mean, Jesus. The thing is, if you book one, the other casting directors hear about you, and suddenly, because you've booked that one, you're like kind of on a fast track for a little while to maybe booking some other ones.
Yeah, I've heard tell of that fast track. Never actually experienced it myself.
Yeah,
no, I haven't either.
Yeah.
And there's
people
like
yeah, you get one and you're off to the races. I'm
but
like,
my
I
wife's
got one,
like, why the fuck do you do these things?
I auditioned for five more
them?
Years and got fucking nothing.
Yeah, they're hard to get, man. I've been auditioning for those goddamn things forever. I haven't booked one for quite a while.
Yeah.
But getting, you know, you get close. You get to the last three. Yeah. You get to you're on hold. I was on hold last week. I didn't even know. I didn't even fucking know. They called to release me. I'm like, I didn't even know I was on hold.
Oh, yeah. I've had
shit.
That happen.
Ugh.
You're not on hold for today anymore. You're like, when was I on hold?
But that's a rough.
I was on hold for something and didn't get it this week as well.
Yeah. That shit sucks, man. You take breaks.
I'm just so used to it. It's like,
you just take breaks. That's the thing that'll
just
you take
go,
breaks.
Just go, you know what? My job is auditioning. I'm never going to book anything. And then maybe you'll be pleasantly surprised one day.
Well, I had a guy, you know, talk about acting shit that you get. Like, this has got to be like, I don't know, man, 6-7 years ago. I was done with the radio show with Brewer, on the road a ton. Just, you know, totally getting by and family and life is fine. We're comfortable, but I really have to grind it out. I'm grinding it out on the road a lot.
Yeah,
and this guy,
off to keep up.
Yeah, playing everywhere, man. This guy emails me and says, listen, we met, remember the old club on the west side? I don't think it's there anymore. It used to be a really nice club that opened up a few years back. What the hell was it called? Lower West Side, not too far.
Oh, Comics.
Comics. So one night I was headlining there, and the guy introduced himself. Remember how beautiful the bar was?
Yes.
It was all
and the green room, and it was awesome.
Yeah.
So the guy who did all that is a real Italian guy named Jimmy Gennario or something like that. Older guy in his 50s, right? So after the show that night with Harlan, after the weekend, I was drinking one night with the owner of the club and this guy. Hey, I designed the club. About a year later, I get an email from him. Hey, I don't know if you remember me. I designed the club. And I'm like, yeah, of course I remember you. Now, this guy, what I did know about him when I met him that night is he's like a master craftsman, woodsman, and he has a whole team of guys, and he's made millions designing and building restaurants. Like, they'll fly him out to England to build a restaurant. And then, you know, and on the part time, he was like a small time producer, as far as like not like didn't have any say in it, but like Billy Baldwin movies and like very, you know, that
one
Italian
tough
guy was
cop.
Yeah. Well, yeah, one Brew was in one of his movies and stuff. So he says, call him. So I call him up. Listen, you don't notice, but after that night that we drank together and we hung out, I had an idea for a movie, but I couldn't find Tony P. And I was not writing this movie until I found Tony P. And I found him in you. And I wrote the whole movie, Pete. I didn't want to bother you until I finished it. You got to be Tony P. I mean, and this guy smokes a lot of pot. He was doing it that night. And you know I do too. And he goes, Pete, we're ready to go. I took all my building crew guys. They're all off at the restaurants right now. We have a bunch of money, and right now I rented a giant old church in Staten Island. We're blacking the windows. We're building all the sets inside so he can smoke pot nonstop, right?
In the church, like, while you're shooting this movie.
I can do all your scenes in 2 weeks. I need you for 2 weeks. You can stay with me in Staten Island in my apartment that I'm renting out there, or I'll put you in a Ramada Inn. I'll give you $10,000 for 10 days. And, you know, like 7 years ago, you know, or whatever it was, I was like, I could really use this money and be home. And so,
fuck yeah. Plus, you're getting a star in a movie.
And you get to be in Staten Island.
Well, all that part, I was almost at the point hoping the movie would, like, this. I'm like, in my head, I'm like, the movie won't go nowhere. I'll get 10G and split. So I go, all right, send the contract. I didn't even tell managers and agents because, what the fuck, I want this money, you know? Fuck it, they don't need to know. So I get off the phone, I tell Jackie, I'm like, yeah, Jack, so this guy's going to give me 10 grand for actually 9 days, but, you know, and she goes, so some guy just called you, drank beer with, he's going to give you $10,000 to be this leader. And I go, yeah. And she goes, well, we'll see when you get the contract. He sends me the contract, and it literally is typed out by him, and it says, I need Pete for 9 days, of which I will give him, he spelled which, W-I-T-C-H, right?
Shit. So, a haunted contract.
This shit is all sketchy. So we cut to, I'll say I'll do it, give me 5G when I get there and 5G when I'm done. So I get out to Staten Island. I tell him I'll stay at his apartment because I want to be in heavy in the script and hang out with you and stuff, right? So
right.
he gives me the 5G, and he does. He's got this whole little old, this big old church that's just a giant room. And what really turned me on was he's showing me, like goddamn, the cutting room in New York City. If you go into the cutting room, the entire bar of the cutting room is a giant guitar, And in the lobby of the cutting room, if you look up, there's a chandelier made of guitars. This guy made this shit, man. Huh. It's like, he's like a craftsman. And he's like, he had such a big vision. And he's like, I'm so sick of being a silent producer. I'm putting my own money into it. We're going to fucking make our own thing, man. And he got a giant green screen. And he built my character is Tony P. I'm a mob guy, obviously. But he built this old replica of a World War One airplane built out of like a light wood, and he put it on four giant springs, so it's about 10 feet off the ground, and he's got the green screen there, and he's like, here's this scene. I have a sidekick, Bruno. And he goes, oh, what? And this movie was so crazy, and this is how he's telling me the scene. He goes, this is what you're going to do. You and Bruno are going to be reflecting on your great-grandpappy and his great-grandpappy, who also happened to fly together in World War One. And then you're going to go, oh, I miss great-grandpa. And we cut to that, and now you're on the plane as Tony P, but you look like the grandpappy, and you shoot down the Red Baron, right? Now, after you shoot down the Red Baron,
Snoopy,
you're going to pull... He goes, you're going to pull out a fucking picnic tablecloth and put it on the front of the plane. It's one of these planes, like, where I have the goggles and I'm in the front and this fat Italian guy's in the back. And then we're going to have fans blowing on you. It's going to look like you're in the air. You're going to put down the picnic thing. You're going to pull out wine, and then you're going to go, oh, there's nothing I want more after this than to bite into my super salty sub. And then... And he goes, and then as you go to bite into your super salty sub, here's the deal. You shot down the Red Baron, but what you don't realize, he's now in a parachute. And as you bite into your super salty sub, he's going to swing by in a parachute and pull the sub out of your mouth right before you bite into it. But here's the deal. Our Red Baron guy, I already made the costume. It's total Red Baron with the goggles. It's a fucking midget, and we're gonna have him on a crane, and we're gonna swing him by on this giant crane. And as you fight in, we can only do like six takes. You can't keep these little people up there too long. It's a whole legal thing. And this is kind of that's how crazy this film was, man, and what we were doing. But
Dude, where can we watch it?
Yeah,
Bailey, we did a scene called Cash Cab. I fucking sent it to you at the time and said, take a look at this, bro. How crazy is this shit? And you never ever responded to me. Yes,
dude, what do you mean?
Well, one of the things
you sent me a scene from this movie.
Yes, because one of the scenes in the movie is Tony P. That's my character.
Right.
Not Bruno.
Yeah. No, Bruno's a sidekick. I'm always trying to make money and all that kind of shit. So one scene, I go up to a guy in a cab. It's an old-time cab. I sent you this, man. And I basically...
Dude, I think I remember... This is a few years ago, huh?
Yeah, and then I go, hey,
I couldn't open it. I was in Australia. And I couldn't...
Yeah.
I was on a computer in Australia, and I couldn't open the video that you sent me.
I think there has to be a resend on that.
I got to look back through my email. I might still have it.
Listen, I will find it today. Because this movie needed to go away. It was so fucking ridiculously embarrassing. But the thing that was so crazy about it was, I mean, this guy just had a bunch of money, and he had this vision. And it was so crazy because he would literally, like, we would smoke pot. Or, like, in the middle of taping, he'd be like, after the scene, he'd go, that was great, Pete, that was great. And then we'd walk over, and he's like, let's smoke it up and talk about it. And we'd smoke it. And, like, he would buy sushi for everybody at night. But the thing is, as much as he's got this giant plane, and it's so cool, and I got this big fake machine gun, and I'm shooting a Red Baron down with a machine gun and shit. What we don't have is, at the end, here's the deal. This is the best part. The Red Baron swings by him, and he takes my sub, and he goes, ah, fuck. And Germany's like, fuck you, but I got your sub, right? And then I look over at the fat Italian guy, Bruno, and I go, Bruno, he took my fucking Super Saudi sub. Because we're trying to sell that me and Tony P have this plane. So I go, he took my Super Saudi sub, and then I turn around to Bruno. I go, save this plane for my great great grandson Tony P, because I'm going after my sub. And I look down and I go, you motherfucker. And I jump down after the Red Baron, a la Point Break, right? So we don't have a fucking match and shit. So he sends his guys to Home Depot to get like six camping sleeping mats, and he stacks those things really high. We all blow them up,
and you just jump out of the plane onto those.
And I'm gonna dive into them, and I'm like, Tony, I'm good. His name is Tony too. I'm like, I'm gonna bounce all over. He's like, no, we'll catch you. We'll have people around. We'll catch you. So crazy.
Wait, here's my question.
This is awesome.
Was the Super Sardis sub like product placement in there? Or was that just...
That's what I was thinking. Yeah. Like, is that an advertisement that he signed up for?
No. It's, you know, he's so Brooklyn and stuff. Is there, you guys know Saudis? The famous?
He just,
it's so Italian that he thinks like that would be like...
To put it, like a Junior's cheesecake or some shit or...
You know. It was just funny to him, you know? And like, I mean, he really had some outrageous... Like, we had one scene where, long story short, I had to kill my wife because, like... she won't stop bitching, and by the end, it's my girl.
I promise not to take that out of context.
So the last scene is like I'm digging a hole with Bruno. I'm like in a lawn with the headlights on, and as her legs are dangling out like the Wizard of Oz out of the back of a car, like you know how Wizard of Oz they were on the outside the house landed on him.
Yeah.
So her legs are dangling, and I'm going, Bruno, I thought she'd never shut the fuck up. And then her legs start wiggling. I'm like, Bruno, she's still alive. Jesus Christ. And then Bruno just starts stabbing her. It's fucking ridiculous, man. Career-ending scenes if you actually had a career. You understand what I'm saying?
Dude, it could be a cult film, though. That could be like a Blue Velvet or some shit, you know.
Don't you fucking look at me! What's the name of it?
Oh, it's called Shut Up and Just Laugh. Something crazy like that. I mean, it was a whole big ending. I mean, put money into it. It was fun and wild, but man, and you know... It's just the power of showbiz. Yeah. I mean, you're making this absolutely ridiculous, crazy thing, but you're all around people that are making it with you. And when there's no one else around but all you, you truly convince yourself. Yeah. I mean, I think I was getting an Oscar nominee. I mean, it was just fucking you know? And then
those things. You really never know. Look how many shitty movies. You know, there's great movies that get acclaim, but there'll be like shitty movies that just, you know, for whatever reason, take off. Now, this sounds like a very specific.
I truly had to know. When I first got on the set and he gave me the 5G, he's like, we're going to start with you around 3 p.m. We're just wrapping up this other scene. I go, yeah, no, take your time. I'm going to go for a walk. I slow jogged down the hill of Staten Island to the Chase Bank and put a rush job on the check to make sure it didn't bounce.
Because you don't know the guy. Yeah.
And he was totally generous and fair and stuff, but I just, dude, I just could. Yeah, it was wild.
I did this movie that ended up being called "Don't Shoot the Pharmacist."
Yeah. Yeah, I know that movie.
Which is now like kind of known. I've actually had people come up to me at airports and go, "Hey." And
really?
I'm expecting them to be like, "You're the guy from Cash Cab." And they're like, "Aren't you the guy from Don't Shoot the Pharmacist?" And I'm like, "Who the fuck watched that movie?" I'm not saying it's a big hit or anything. It's more the similarities in the stories. Like, this guy just came around and was like, his name's Dave Breutman. He's a great guy. You guys might even remember he came. He was coming around to the comedy clubs for
a
while, looking to get people into his movies. Right? Yeah. He was a pharmacist who worked graveyard shift at this little pharmacy in Sheepshead Bay, Coney Island, Sheepshead Bay, and all this crazy stuff happened to him. So he saved up his money to make a movie about it, and it wasn't. None of it was as ridiculous as what, as crazy as what you're talking about. But like, he had never made a movie before, so he didn't really know exactly what he was doing. So there's some very funny parts, and he's partially deaf, and it affects his speech. So he's directing the movie, but he's never directed a movie before, and he has a slight speech impediment. Which makes for some pretty funny fucking little scenarios.
Yeah.
One thing that he did wrong was I was the lead in the movie.
Yeah.
And he would shoot out everyone else and then come back and I would finish up my stuff after all of the day players were gone, which is like the opposite.
Yeah.
So I had all this stuff to do. I did 90% of my scenes to no one.
Oh no.
Oh, my
because
God.
They were already home. We had shot them and then we'd set up the reverse after they were gone because we didn't have the money to do keep everybody around all day. So what that meant was that Dave, the director and writer of the movie, partially deaf man with a speech impediment, has never directed a film before that time, would be not just directing the movie, but also acting out the role of whatever person was no longer there to do the half of my scene.
Oh shit! Yes, with the impediment, the
for every and he did it for like everyone, like a guy who was taller than me, a very attractive woman, a hooker, a bank robber. You know, like everybody.
It's like those casting readings where they got the dude with the fucking clipboard reading.
Yeah, it was so fucking funny because he's a guy with a lot of heart and he really believed in what he was doing. So he would try really hard. And at one point, he's just rolling around on the floor yelling and none of us can even really discern who he's supposed to be or what he's doing.
Well,
like,
what if
everybody ends up just dying laughing and he's rolling around on the ground.
Maybe that's exactly what I was going to say. Maybe he was going for that. Like some of you win Oscars and he's like, you know, I had them act with me with my speech impediment because I wanted that uneasiness to come out in the character. That, I mean, who, you know what? Who knows what's right or wrong? Because, you know, you guys know Billy Gardell, right? Obviously.
Yeah,
right?
Sure.
So he did a part in, for Mike and Molly. So he did a part in some Clint Eastwood movie where the Jersey Boys, he's like, we're talking about it and Gardell's telling me, he's like, I was.
He's like their manager for Frankie Valli or whatever.
Yeah.
And I fucking read for that role.
And he goes, the whole part was one day of shooting. I go, wow, but still you worked with Clint, man. Clint Eastwood, director, right? And he goes, well, one thing he did that I thought was interesting, you know, as Gardell talks. And again, who knows what's right or wrong? He goes, Clint Eastwood doesn't say action and cut. He says begin. And then at the end, he goes, that's enough of that.
That's great.
Oh, that's brutal.
And nobody says it to every scene.
He doesn't realize it, but it sounds like he's shitting on what you just did.
Oh, that's great.
Well, I mean, I saw Matt Damon interview when he's talking about the first time he worked with Clint, and he goes, he works really fast, and he goes, you do the take like twice, and he goes, I remember the first couple of days I was working with him. This is in the interview where I saw Matt Damon. It made me laugh so fucking hard. He goes, after we did the take, and Clint goes, cut, rap, moving on. Matt Damon goes up to him. He goes, listen, I got another take. Is there any chance I can do it one more time? Can I do it one more time? And Clint Eastwood goes, yeah, if you want to waste everybody's time.
Oh, you got to love that. That's awesome, man.
He's move it along.
Absolute legend, right? I mean, who's...
Oh, yeah.
Who's higher?
Oh, yeah.
He's a guy, like, if I met him, I think I would be totally starstruck.
Well, I mean, shit, you know, it's, like, interesting how you have these moments in your career. Like Bailey, you hanging out, literally hanging out with Trebek, talking during the Emmys, about the Emmys, and just, you know.
Talking about beating up Bob Barker with a baseball bat.
Yeah, God, what a great story. What a great story, man.
It was all Trebek.
Oh, yeah, that's great.
So it's just funny how, you know, it's funny how, like, you know, by the time you end up in these kind of positions, especially guys like us who've been grinding it for so long and stuff, that when you are in these positions, it like almost takes till after you're out of that moment to go, holy shit, that was a moment. Because, we just always got our nose to the ground trying to get some, you know, get it going and stuff. And,
Totally. I agree, man. And then you look back and you go, oh, shit, I actually did that. That actually happened.
Like, for me, a big one last year was we're doing this one particular episode of Kevin Can Wait where Ray Romano was on. And we had this whole run where he had, like, a ponytail in the back of his hair. And he takes it out. And I was heavily involved with writing it and stuff. And then, like...
It was great, dude. I watched that run. I watched those bits with Ray. It was great. It was really funny. Yeah.
Thanks, man. We had, you know, and it was good because, you know, Kevin was having fun with Ray. But, like, right at the end of the episode, Ray and Kevin are in the same office. It's a whole big thing. But I had an idea and a take, and everyone liked it. And they're like, explain, you know, go in. And I always kind of had, right out of the gate, I was allowed to go up to Kevin, tell him alts for jokes and stuff. So I'm out there, and it's Kevin and Ray, and they're sitting face to face in this chair. And I'm like, Kev, if you say this and then da da da, and then Ray could do that, man, that would be really funny. And then Ray's like, but what if I do that? And I go, but if you do that, then that. And no. And that. And then, you know, you do the whole thing and you go back to your thing and you watch it. But it doesn't take till like later on that night, I'm alone in that apartment because my wife and daughter already bailed on me in Oyster Bay. And you're sipping a beer and you have that moment where you're like, what the fuck, man, I was sitting there with Ray and Kevin on the set telling them how it should go. Did anyone even get a photo of that?
Yeah, that just happened. We need to put a stick in the ground and mark that just fucking happened.
That is great.
Yeah, you know, and by the time you're hanging out with Trebek or DC, all these things you've done, it's almost like, you know, you felt like you should have been there so much earlier that you don't even enjoy it in the moment because you're just like, yep, you just did it. You're just
tired from the journey.
Yeah. Well, I told this before, but it's short and it applies to this. But I did this movie with Sam Jackson and Julianne Moore called Freedomland.
Julianne Moore.
Yeah.
Motherfucker, I read for that one too.
I was a hospital cop.
Yeah, we both went into that weird place that I've only ever gone once to audition.
That's the only time I went there too.
Yeah.
Bailey, you read for so many auditions. I'm starting to think you've been lying and you actually work for the casting agency.
Don't you think I'd give myself a couple of roles if I had any fucking say in it?
Oh, wait. It was great. It was great. So I had this scene with Julianne Moore and Sam Jackson. And
holy shit.
And,
fucking awesome.
It was great, man. And I'm the hospital cop and we're doing whatever. And in between, I asked Sam Jackson, I'm like, dude, you work constantly. You work constantly. He's like, I go, how do you pick your movies? And I'm expecting this really intense theatrical answer. And he's like, golf. I love golf. There's a good golf course near there. That's how I picked the movie.
And then right afterwards, far from what I expected.
Dude, right afterwards, he did some movie about golf in Scotland. And it's like the most... You would never think like Sam Jackson in a movie in Scotland about golf, but he just loved the golf course there. It was just so fucking funny.
So they're
man.
Like, let's somebody else caught on.
Yeah,
that's great.
Let's gotta make these movies near the world's best golf courses. We get Sam Jackson
exactly.
That's it. You got an independent movie. You got it. I really love Sam Jackson for this role. Well, then let's film it by Augusta.
That's it.
Yeah, set it up right when the Masters is happening.
That's great, man.
Or a week before. That's crazy, man.
But that's how all that stuff is, you know. It's just, you never know. You never know how people pick their movies. You never know where you get to sit down and tell Ray Romano and Kevin James how to be funny.
Listen, here's what you need to do, you guys. The two of you collectively don't understand what you need to do to make this seem funny.
That's great.
I, Pete Corielli, will tell you.
No, it wasn't like that.
Oh, I know. Man. I know. I'm just fucking around,
just,
dude.
You know, the work.
Those guys are great, dude.
Every time we do a taping, though, like, especially, right, like I said, right out of the gate, you know, the way I got the job was Kev's like, been a fan of your stuff and listened to the cast and saw your Showtime thing. And so when he said, you know, why don't you come over here and write? He's like, you know, if you have an alt when we're live, bring them. And like the first 3 weeks of live tapings, you literally go up and you give them, like I do, not everyone can, but you go and you go, hey, what if you say this halfway through the scene, like for the next take? And that guy is so ridiculously talented. Like you'll give him a line and then I'll go back to sit down. And it's almost like you lit a firecracker, because you light a firecracker, then you, or a firework, and you go back and you're like, all right, here it goes. And I look at the other writer, my buddy, and I'm like, God, is he going to remember this line? It's like not till like two pages into the scene. I don't even remember how it goes. And like, you get to it and he nails it and you're like, boom. But then, you know, the odds are going to be, but going into fourth week, fifth week, sometimes you give him a joke and you go back and because I watch on the monitor, I don't even watch right in front of him. I like to look at the monitor and then he does it and it doesn't hit. And then you're like, oh, now. And I look at the other writer, I go, I'm not giving him another one till act three. I'm not even going back.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, especially because he's a comic, with the other comics, you'll give him one, he'll get nothing. And then he'll yell out in front of the whole crowd, where's Corielli? Like,
oh, that's hilarious.
That sounds fun, though. That sounds like a good atmosphere, dude.
Yeah, what a great gig.
Yeah, it is, man. It is. Because you also get the nod and the high five when it does crush.
Yeah. That's awesome, dude. I'm psyched for you that you're writing on it. I know, man. It's not your preferred hours, but it's a good gig. And Kevin's hilarious.
Fun, man. Yeah.
I think we're going to have to wrap it up. I think that's going to have to be it for this episode of Tall But True. Thanks to our guest, Mr. Pete Corielli. Great talking to you, hanging out with you for a while, bro.
Awesome, man. I mean, I adore you guys. You guys are just like, shit, we go so far back, man. I mean, I don't want to die, but if I do die, you two can speak at the funeral. And you also have known me long enough to know who can't. So, you know.
Oh, right. Well, I'm honored.
Yeah, man.
I'm not going to start writing anything yet.
Bailey, keep it short, Bailey.
Wrap it up, Jesus. You've been up there for a half hour.
I'll do it in a character.
You can come in and give me alts if you want.
Great hanging with you guys, man.
Yeah, it's great having you, Corielli.
Dude,
man.
It was fantastic. We'll do it again.
Absolutely.
What do you want to
man.
Plug? What's your podcast and all that good stuff?
The Pete and Sebastian Show. We're on SiriusXM Fridays at 5:00. And then you could just go to my website, PeteCorielli.com, and the Pete and Sebastian Show's there too.
Awesome. Check out Pete and Sebastian's podcast.
Two funny guys.
And go and see Pete if you get a chance, guys. He's fucking hilarious.
Yes, indeed.
Thanks, man. Thanks,
dude,
guys.
You've always been so funny, man, and it's great to hang out with you again. I'm glad everything's
Absolutely.
Going so well. Have fun on Kevin Can Wait, dude, and we'll have you on again. We'll tell stories again. I know we got plenty more.
Yes.
Absolutely, man. Great hanging, guys.
Yep,
later,
too,
brother.
Later.
All right, so that's it for this episode of Tall But True, everybody. Thank you again for tuning in or downloading or streaming or whatever it is that you do. Please subscribe if you haven't yet. You can get us on Audio Boom. You can figure out what I'm up to at therealbenbailey.com.
And, I'm DC Benny, the real DC Benny on Instagram. And we have our live show once a month.
Oh, yeah, we should
plug
that.
Fat Black Pussycat.
Yeah, once a month at the Fat Black Pussycat in the Village, which is under the Comedy Cellar umbrella. It's a great club on West 3rd Street.
Yes.
Right next to Minetta Garage.
Yes.
Across from the Bitter...
Yeah, and Bailey was just playing milk carton golf there.
I was just playing a little milk carton golf in the wee hours of the morning after our last one.
Yeah, it was awesome.
It's usually like the second Wednesday of every month. It's a Wednesday in the middle of the month.
Yes.
It's Tall But True Live. It might be listed as Comedy Storytellers. Come check that out. And thanks for listening, you guys. Hope you're enjoying it.